We get things underway this afternoon in Hour 2 by welcoming in our friend, writer Colin Fleming. Hello there, Colin.
Rick's 10-spot Kimball, the Decade Man. Congratulations, buddy.
Thank you. Thank you very much. It's proof that you don't need, well, talent or an audience to succeed in this business. It's incredible. It's just lean on good people like you and the rest will take care of itself.
Sometimes you just need a vehicle to get there, man.
Exactly. Exactly. Hey, I hope you appreciate it, by the way. I don't know if you saw it, but in our Facebook post for the show today, I always include pictures of four guests, and then I decided to go back to the picture with your beanie today, your talisman.
Oh, yeah, really? I haven't seen that yet. You used to mix the photos up somewhat, and I'd be like, oh, I remember sending them that one. But I know you're a wily and crafty guy, so you have this giant chest of wares, I'm sure, that you can pluck out whatever you need.
Indeed, indeed. Well, we're going to talk music today and some great music that, I don't know, maybe not everybody is familiar with. And let's start with Dylan's Basement Tapes, which in many ways, I don't know, is it safe to say that was sort of the first of the officially authorized outtakes, basement tapes, hidden gems, whatever we call them?
Yeah, I'd say that you would be pretty close. Now, someone might be a stickler and find some random, trying to think of like jazz. There could be something in jazz along those lines. But for rock and roll, yeah. And that would be partially because of the bootleg, which you have the first bootleg, essentially, right? With
right.
Leaking of this material, which was not, I don't really trust people when they say, oh, I didn't intend it for release. It's like, if you know what you're doing and it's good, you're not like, oh, no, woe is me, it came out. Like, right? You're sort of always, I think, thinking of posterity. There are certain people, they write letters, whether you're James Adrian, you're F. Scott Fitzgerald, or you're John Keith. You're not probably thinking it's just going to be for Sally Simpson that you're sending it to out there in Who Land. It's going to maybe be seen by a lot of other people later, and that's certainly how these recordings played out. When Dylan gathered his longtime acolytes, the band, at that house that has since become known as Big Pink in upstate New York there in February of 1967. They were there for a bunch of months, really, almost the majority of the year. And it's a documentation of their process. What Dylan was doing, too, was deciding that he needed a new direction in life. And when an artist is finding a new direction in life, what a great artist tends to do is write a book, write a story, flip the recording switch on, and go from there. They chart the process. They chart the growth, as it were. So you have all of these sessions that have come out in myriad forms, right? Giant box set of, like, everything. But what we're really talking about is the original double album that was released in June 1975, so 45 years ago, which was a whittling down of these gargantuan session tapes, informal session tapes.
And this was, am I right, really the first recording he had done after his motorcycle accident?
It was. And that was, if you've had like a loss in your life, or you've had a debilitating disease, or in this case, an accident, there is a stock-taking that occurs for thoughtful people that will change you. We all know somebody who's maybe gone through a bad divorce who is a different person after, maybe a better person if they, like, really stuck prior, or maybe just a bitter person. But Dylan was someone who was focused on growth, and he was cutting these recordings, which, it's like the skeletal Americana. There wasn't really anything like this. This is not what anybody was doing at the time. Everybody was doing psychedelia, proto-metal, sort of fuzz rock, garage music. They were doing all of that. And Dylan starts doing this rustic, post-Woody Guthrie, but Dust Bowl type of Sun Session Elvis stuff that sounds as old as, like, time itself in some ways. And it was very funny, too, these songs he was writing. And when I first got into Dylan, the thing that I liked the most, and I imagine this is not very typical, was how funny he was. Like, you listen to those early albums, the Freewheeling Bob Dylan, like, yes, there's stuff on it, like, Don't Think Twice, It's All Right, which, of course, isn't funny. But then there's other stuff that is just so witty. I mean, it's kind of funny, like, in that Bob Newhart way, not in that, like, goonery sort of Adam Sandler like pratfall idiot way, but like in a clever way. And I was a clever kid. I thought it was hilarious. And the jokes in the basement tape, like they're not just funny, but they're really bawdy. Like it's the type of bawdiness actually that you get in Shakespeare and that you get in Mozart, like Don Giovanni. But you know how it's like something really heavy happens in Shakespeare, and then you have like a drunken porter who has to go to the door, and they're like, "Can you get this up, sir?" He's like, "I've had too much to drink to be able to get it up." Waka waka. Like Shakespeare's doing jokes. Dylan is doing a lot of jokes like that throughout the basement tapes, while he's also giving you some of his heaviest songs ever, really, his most emotionally heavy songs.
And one of the many things that I love and respect about Bob Dylan is that he didn't give a damn about expectations, whether it was in that shift to an electronic sound in 1965 or in some ways never completely leaving behind what people broadly called protest music for these very personal songs.
Leaders lead, and I think they figure that with what they do and the level they do it at, if they hew to that line, that eventually the people will get behind them and follow. So that's, I would imagine, what was going through Dylan's head. It's really no different than like Bobby Orr, Wayne Gretzky. No one played hockey that way, right? But then people adapted to their version, the best they could, of what those other players were doing. So Dylan was simply Americana Gretzky, and with these Canadians, and you had a lot of joy in these sessions. I would say something like Apple Suckling Tree, which is kind of like a throwaway number, but it's always stood out to me because it's just so much fun. It has so much rhythmic swagger to it, and it's just almost like this like shanty of the land. That's how I think of it. It's not like this clipper ship shanty. It's something you would sing like in an arbor by an apple tree, and it's just rollicking. It has a bit of rockabilly, but it really just rollicks. And I think that's like the spirit that he was working from, even when he put in some of these kind of emotional depths that you had mentioned.
What did it do to change and alter the perception of Dylan coming as it did after the release of Blood on the Tracks?
It's another phase. Now, things got out of chronological sequence, of course, with this 1975 release and Blood on the Tracks preceding that in 74, and completely different sound, right? Like, it doesn't sound anything like the same musician, and it's not the same backing band. But really, I think what it showed was that this guy's never going to do the same thing. It's always going to be different. It's going to be the same, and it's always going to be different. And the artist that I've always respected, I mean, I'm that way like every day. But the artist that I've always cared about, Melville, Dylan, Dickens to a degree, the Beatles to a degree, you are always getting some kind of remaking. And yet, within a bar, you knew who you were, in this case, listening to. So I think that was just another way of Dylan mixing up his particular medicine. The very best cannot be stagnant. They have to be anti-sessile. They have to be moving forward. Like we've talked about before, live your life like a thrown knife. Make your art the same way. And that's what Dylan was signposting to everybody who was listening, that's what he was going to continue to do.
We're talking with Colin Fleming here on Downtown and discussing music this week. And let's move on to a reissue of a sometimes maligned Rolling Stones album that had some classics on there, but Why did everyone not embrace Goat's Head Soup when it first came out in 1973?
I think of it almost like a bag of Doritos. Like it's kind of, this is a highly caloric release, right? Like it's not a double album like the record that preceded it in Exile on Main Street, but it's very nougaty, right? It's very plummy. There is a lot of like, yeah, let's just go for it. Let's just have a meandering guitar solo. It's kind of like the Stones version of Oasis's Be Here Now, which I think is a pretty good record, but people flag it off because it has some bloat on it. And there are some love handles on Goat's Head Soup, and some of the songs could be a little lacking in focus. And you get some great songs, though. You get Angie, you get, I was thinking about this, it's probably a song you rock out to every morning, Star Star. We'll call it Star Star, but it's sort of like their Chuck Berry pastiche.
Yeah, and that's funny you mention that, because that's my favorite song on the album.
That's a great song, but it's like, you have all of these lascivious left-handed compliments. It's like if I was a woman, right, and I said, oh, Rich Kimball, I like your salt and peppery hair. But you were Mick Jagger, you could say to me, oh, Miss Fleming. And I, by the way, in this scenario, I own a pussy hat. You could say, oh, Miss Fleming, I like how you keep your pussy hat so clean. But I'm not talking about headwear, see? We can do that. That's technically allowed. So that's what it's really not as foul, though, as Stray Cat Blues from Beggar's Banquet. And I had the thesis advisor, and he's sitting there, and he's like, I'm writing about this. I'm being, like, pretty open about some of the lyrics in Stray Cat Blues. He goes, oh, you're referring to the capaciousness of the certain orifice of the female. I'm like, yeah, okay, buddy.
That's sure, that.
What yeah. That's what he was doing, too. So you have that, and you just it's one of those albums that, like, becomes more beloved after time, after it's pasted when it comes out. And with this particular reissue, it's greatly abetted by having this bootleg that everyone who cares about the Stones would already have anyway, but called Brussels Affair. So it's the Stones in Brussels, as you'd expect, in 1973. And 1972 and 73 was a live peak for them. They played so fast. They're like the Ramones of blues rock at this point. And they could be, like, not as sloppy as they were going to get, like, come 1975 and 76, once Mick Taylor leaves. He's crucial to what's happening right now, and he has some great solos on the record. But it's one of the best. If you just released it again as a standalone live album, you would have it on that short list of some of the others that we've talked about over the years.
Up next, we want to talk about the Byrds. And I always feel like, yeah, I know they're in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, but the Byrds don't get enough credit for the many things they did, the different styles. They essentially invented the country rock genre, but they went in so many different directions with psychedelic music. And then in this album from 50 years ago, Byrds Untitled, were working on, well, you know, a lighthearted musical based on Peer Gynt.
Yeah, right. Just that cheery Ibsen to put a smile on your face. And this is, it was their ninth album, so it's cool. I like this kind of thing. It's half live, half studio. And it actually came out on September 14th, 1970. So we're almost like bang on the 50-year anniversary. And you're right. They were another artist like Dylan, who, of course, they looked up to, who was always changing it. And they might not have invented country rock, like Graham Parsons, you could look at somebody like that, but they amplified it. They were the ones who kind of got it out. They liked the Beatles didn't invent a lot of things at all when you look at it. They amplified things that people had already done. They didn't necessarily steal from them, but sometimes their popularity resulted in them getting credit for starting things that they didn't actually start. So you have both of the sides hold up fantastically well. The hero of the album is a man who's going to die tragically at age 29 in 1973. He's actually from Lewiston, Maine. I don't know if that's close to you. I don't think so. Clarence White, who plays guitar, because they had multiple lineups, the Byrds, even though they had only been around at this point, like, what, 6-7 years? And it's one of the great guitar albums in rock and roll history, both the live set and the studio set. But people talk about 8 Miles High, rightly so, for 1966, because it's one of the best singles ever, isn't it? The 16-minute version, the live version on this set, really is better than it. Like, it's insane. If you listen to, the beginning of it, they give you like 10 minutes before, like, they start singing. It's just this out of this world byplay between these musicians that keeps getting more and more intense. And the knock on the Byrds when they started was like, they're the Monkees. These dudes can't play. They can't. But you listen to these live recordings, and by 1970, they were just one of the best jam bands. But they were tighter because they had the songs. But on the planet, they were just so fantastically cohesive.
And as you mentioned, this lineup that they had by 1970, musically speaking, a lot of folks think might have been the best Byrds lineup of all.
There's actually a live recording, you can find it on YouTube, from 1967, where like a couple band members don't show up, and it's just three of them playing at this club in California. And it's great. Like, it's scorching. It doesn't sound like this band. And then there's another recording from 68 that shows off their live country side. They're not really doing country rock by this time, but as players, I mean, people talk about the Grateful Dead and everything and how well they listen to each other. Again, go to that version, that 16-man version of 8 Miles High, and it's just fantastically intense. When the vocals finally do kick in, it's like Wagner with that resolution of the famous Tristan chord. And it's just this payoff. The ear has certain expectations. It has things it wants to hear. And the great musicians, and great writers too, they set up the ear for those expectations. So when you deliver those lines, the ear or the eyes, whatever it is, if you're reading, it's just like, oh, wow, manna, this is what I've always wanted, and sounds like the best thing ever.
And also for the studio sessions that they recorded for the album, it was a chance for them to reunite with Terry Melcher, who had produced their first two albums.
Yes, those classic first two albums, which are, they're like sister albums, really, right? You think of them as really going together pretty well with Turn, 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 the second one, and Mr. Tambourine Man, the first one with, of course, the big jangly Rickenbacker, Roger McGuinn, who's still playing that Rickenbacker. That's the thing, too. Like, he never forsakes that 12-string Rickenbacker. That's a constant of their sound, even though it changes. And they have, I think, probably the most famous song from the studio side is Chestnut Mare, which is from that aborted Ibsen project. And it's just like this song about these mythologies of freedom and restraint and hunting down this horse, all this symbolism. But it's not like that cheesy, over-the-top, hippie symbolism. It's like one of those, what's that movie with the famous actress there, and it's like the pony she loves, Elizabeth Taylor, whoever, a horse.
Oh, National Velvet.
Yeah, it's kind of like this rock and roll 1970 version of that. And it's not this sugary kind of like, oh God, where are we going with this symbolism type of song? Like it's focused, it's tight.
And finally, we want to talk about a 1968 box set from Cream. Is this from the Goodbye Tour?
It is. It's the end. It's like, see you later, people. This is all you get. So it's four shows, and it's three of them are from California, San Diego, L.A., and what's the other one? There's Royal Albert Hall to cap it off. Oakland is the other California show. And so they didn't like each other, these three guys. And they never really liked each other that much, like when they started out in 1966. And by 1968, they really didn't like each other. But I've always been into bands. And there hasn't been something like this in a long time, where they're classified as both pop and rock. Now, think about this. Cream, when they came out, they were considered a pop band who also did rock. So was Jimi Hendrix. Like, they'd be in these magazines, like these teen beat, teeny bopper type of magazines, and they could have, like, the Yardbirds were like that too. Do you know what I mean? They're doing like these ferocious sounds, but they're still like, cut Eric Burden out and paste him to your wall, right? Like, those things. And you could do that with like Ginger Baker. You wake up in the morning, like, there'd be this big afro, be like, what are you doing, man? And so I always liked that, because to me it signified these groups that made art but also gave you populist entertainment. Now, for players, Cream, they dropped the I liked how they were the Cream when they started out. Just like so on the nose, arrogant, but like it was true. They wanted to think of them as each of them as the best players on their instrument. Now, they might not have been, but they weren't any of them particularly far off. So you get these shows that they know that they're like Michael Jordan, the Bulls, The Last Dance, right? They know it's going to be the end of it. And such fiery shows, and just these improvisations on songs like these, just Delta blues songs like Spoonful, plus their own song. I was on my walk the other day, and it wasn't from this box set, but it was on campus at BC, and I heard Sunshine of Your Love cranking from like a dorm window. I thought, like, oh, that's cool, right? It was like, people still listen to like good good organic music. I know a guy like you. You always say, what's that new one you're always dancing to? You told me now, like WAP, right? You know the hit I'm talking about, Kimball. You told me you like to towel off with that when you get out of the shower. I'm like, all right, well, this is a bit of an overshare from Kimball, but he has 10 years, so I should just act like it's cool. So, but Cream was doing like just all these, like they were innovating. I like that they innovated every night. Clapton stopped innovating after 1970. And then he just, like, coast for the rest of his career. But you had the sense, when you listen to them and you listen to these gigs, that they were inventing each night on the stage. They never knew what they might come up with.
And you get to hear that because, essentially, each disc is a different venue and performance, but basically the same set list.
Yeah, the set list doesn't... And that's kind of ironic with Cream, right? You think a band that improvises so much would just be yanking the set list in every which direction, but they really don't. Like, they close at the Royal Albert Hall with Steppin' Out, which they don't close at the other shows with. And that was this sort of showpiece. Guitarists would have a showpiece, like blues type of show-off number. Like, Jeff Beck had one, Beck's Boogie and the Yardbirds. And this was Clapton's show-off piece. His, back in, like, chamber music days, it would be called like your party piece sort of thing. Paul McCartney had, when his folks would come by when he was like 12, he'd have a party piece that he would sing that would impress everyone. So this was Eric Clapton's party piece. But yeah, the set list doesn't change very much, but certainly the performances do. The length of the solos, like think of something like Toad, the huge drum solo from Ginger Baker. That's so different every time. And like everyone's like, oh, John Bonham, Moby Dick. Oh, no, come on. Listen to Toad. It's so much better. It's so much more virtuosically accomplished as like a piece of playing than any version of Moby Dick out there. And then at the end of it, sometimes Ginger Baker would get so exhausted he would like pass out and the other two would carry on.
Talking rock and roll, some classics here with Colin Fleming this afternoon on Downtown. Colin, we thank you as always, my friend. We'll check in again next week.
Sounds good.
ColinFlemingLit.com. Subscribe as well to the Many Moments More blog.